Welcome to the Christian Science Monitor. I'm Philip Moore for Radio Reading Services. This week I'm reading from the August 12th, 2019 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. The cover story this week, Woodstock Nation, How 3 days of Mud, Music, and Flower Power Changed a Generation and Still Resonate Today. The stories by staff writer Stephen Humphreys. However, before we delve into this week's feature story, here is some background and context from editor Mark Sappenfield. Editor Sappenfield's column this week, The Woodstock I Never Knew. As editor, I know that the Christian Science Monitor should change the way I see the world. I just never expected that to be true about Woodstock. This summer is the 50th anniversary of the legendary music festival in upstate New York, and in this week's cover story, staff writer Stephen Humphreys looks at its legacy. The story he tells is one that I had never imagined. As someone born after Woodstock took place, I knew my thoughts of the event was undoubtedly colored by caricature and myth. I imagined a lot of mud, a lot of music, and a lot of stuff not at all appropriate for discussion in a family newspaper. And those things certainly did happen. But in reading Stephen's story, I caught a glimpse of something else that happened, too. And more to the point, I caught a glimpse of something that was arguably more important, because it is why, 50 years later, we are still even talking about Woodstock. The reason Woodstock endures is that for those who attended, and many others, it was a moment when the veil of the everyday world was drawn back, revealing what they hoped the world could be. Put another way, a massive experimental pop-up kibbutz tested a fundamental question: can a gathering the size of Tulsa, Oklahoma, actually live peace and love, not just as a slogan, but as a palpable part of their minute-by-minute being for 3 days? And the answer for so many of them was not just yes, but yes, in a way so deep that the impression was indelible, like a stamp on the heart. Hundreds of thousands of people who felt cast off from society, mocked for their idealism and criticized for their misgivings about the Vietnam War, felt suddenly consequential, and their ideals glowed in the practical ways people treated one another, even amid conditions unacceptable for a refugee camp. You need only read the first few paragraphs of Stephen's story to catch that spirit. In reporting the story, Stephen came across a group of young people visiting Woodstock earlier this year. They were dumbfounded by the sense of mutual purpose that pulsated through the event. Today, when you go to music festivals, you stay in one group, Stephen said, they told him. You don't engage in that communal sense. At Woodstock, people connected to something larger than themselves amid the music. Anniversary stories can often be tired journalism, rehashing well-worn tropes to reinforce cultural myths. But they can also reach back into history to reveal the freshness and newness of thought that has stirred every generation. And that refreshes us today, too. The story of Woodstock tells us something about the nature of the stories we tell ourselves. Woodstock absolutely can be a paean to the hedonism of the me generation. And it can also be a parable of how, for 3 days, a generation touched its best self, and how that glimmer has never entirely disappeared. Now for the cover story by staff writer Stephen Humphreys. Field of Tie-Dyed Dreams, How Woodstock Changed a Generation and Still Resonates Today. Bethel, New York. David Crosby's most enduring memory of Woodstock isn't going on stage at 3 o'clock in the morning. It isn't the fear that Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young felt at playing their second ever show, nor is it the gargantuan crowd teeming like an ant colony on a field in upstate New York. No, the first image that comes to the musician's mind is an incident between a policeman and an attendee. That summer of 1969, hirsute hippies such as Mr. Crosby typically viewed police with fear and suspicion. Blame the tumult of the times. During 1968, there had been several incidents in which police had shot and wounded students and black activists. Most infamously, officers in rear riot gear used clubs and tear gas to disperse hundreds of protesters outside the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Demonstrators routinely referred to the authorities as pigs. At Woodstock, Mr. Crosby witnessed a decidedly different act by a representative of man. A girl cut her foot, recounts Mr. Crosby. She's standing around on one foot, bleeding badly, and this cop, who's just come on duty, and he's got a razor-sharp crease in his pants, and his shoes are as shiny as mirrors, he has really turned out, sees her, walks over in the mud, gets the blood and mud all over himself, picks the girl up, and carries her gently and sweetly to his car, where he lays her on the back seat, again getting the blood and mud all over himself and his uniform and his car. He doesn't care. He's taking care of the girl. And then about 14 hippies push that car out of the mud. After a brief pause, Mr. Crosby's voice softens. I thought to myself, you know, that's working, he says. That's a bunch of human beings, good to each other. 50 years on, Mr. Crosby isn't the only boomer wistfully recalling the seminal events of those 3 days. It isn't just nostalgia for halcyon days when they had more hair, nor is it just a celebration of great performances by iconic musicians. For the baby boom generation, Woodstock is a cultural touchstone that defined an era. A number of social protest movements that bubbled up during the 1960s, opposition to the Vietnam War, a push for free love and personal autonomy, a clamor for civil rights and equality, seemed to converge in that field in upstate New York. In the decades since, the festival has taken on something of a mythological status. That's why the original site, now on the National Register of Historic Places, is the rock music equivalent of a Civil War battlefield. Everyday visitors come from all over the world to see it. Some dressed appropriately for the encounter, with tie-dye splatter across their t-shirts like melted Ben and Jerry's ice cream. More than a dozen books about Woodstock have been released in recent months. A big-screen documentary, Woodstock, 3 Days That Defined a Generation, is scheduled to air on PBS in early August. Today, there's little evidence this bunny slope was once a mudslide that accommodated a stage, speaker towers, and a biblical-scale multitude. It's now as verdant as the Irish meadow, but with the large peace sign subtly mowed in the grass. A team of archaeologists from Binghamton University, State University of New York, excavated the site earlier this year, but the only shrapnel they dug up were pull tabs from cans. What lingers is the legacy. On one side of the field, a stone monument lists all the performers. Duke Devlin, formerly a guide at the Woodstock Museum, just up the road, dubs it the Tomb of the Unknown Hippie. Diane Armstrong made the pilgrimage from Snow Hill, Maryland, because she missed out on the festival when she was a young teen. There was a lot brewing back then, a lot that's in common with what's going on today, says Miss Armstrong, who feels a kinship with the people putting aside differences in a loving community. It gives me hope, and it also makes me feel like all those people who are now in our political system, don't they remember? Because they were all my age. What did they forget? Because even if they weren't here, it was global. It was countrywide. Many Americans, then and now, to be sure, would dismiss the gathering as a bacchanalia in the mud. 3 days of drugs, nudity, subversive music, and psychedelic indulgence by a lost generation of hippies and flower children. But to vast numbers of others, such as Mr. Crosby, Woodstock was an epiphanic moment of pure idealism. Despite the challenge posed by a poorly organized music festival, the multitudes spent the weekend embodying the peace and love they espoused. To them and others who shared the spirit of the moment, Woodstock represents the apotheosis of lofty ideals that still resonate. This was a shift of a whole generation of people watching that phenomenon and identifying with it in some way, says Mary Vandergoot, author of After Freedom, How Boomers Pursued Freedom, Questioned Virtue, and Still Search for Meaning. It was protest music, but honestly, it was deeply optimistic in the sense that there was a belief that if you speak the truth, life will get better. To coincide with Woodstock's 50th anniversary event, co-founder Michael Lang wanted to stage a commemorative festival August 16th through 18th near the original site. The lineup was to feature some performers from the gathering 50 years ago, alongside newer acts such as Halsey and Chance the Rapper. One imagines boomers asking, "Who?" And their prodigy responding, "No. The Who's not on the bill, Granddad." But multiple permit applications were denied, forcing Mr. Lang to consider a new venue in Maryland. Many of the musicians, however, were uninterested in performing at a site so unoriginal from the original. Ultimately, the festival was canceled. A half century ago, Mr. Lang faced similar travails trying to stage a concert. In 1967, he and his cohort, Artie Cornfield, formerly vice president of Capitol Records, set out to establish a recording studio near Woodstock, New York. They had financial backing from the heir to a pharmaceutical company and a young venture capitalist. 2 years later, the four men decided to hold a music and arts festival on the site of the proposed recording studio, but locals rejected the idea. Two other venues were considered, but officials refused to issue permits. The situation was desperate. The festival had already been advertised in publications, such as the New York Times. During a ride through Bethel with a local real estate agent, Mr. Lang dipped down a side road past Max Yasker's dairy farm and spotted the ideal venue, a bowl-shaped meadow. It was July. They only had a month to prepare the site. With just days to go before the event, Mr. Lang's team faced a stark choice given their limited workers and time. They could either build the stage or erect fences and ticket booths around the festival grounds. They could choose the staging. The festival had pre-sold 186,000 tickets via mail order. Without fencing, the organizers would have to let the additional people who showed up in for free. They were expecting 15,000. The predictions were off by only 200,000. The organizers ended up going heavily into debt. The Aquarian Exposition, as it was called, tapped into a countercultural movement that was sweeping the United States. 2 years earlier, in 1967, Time magazine had run a cover story on hippies. The Woodstock organizers apparently didn't read it, or if they did, weren't aware of the number of hippies, peaceniks, rock aficionados, and others who would be drawn to a meadow in upstate New York. In 1965, by some estimates, there were roughly 1,000 pro-typical hippies living in the Bay Area, says cultural anthropologist Grant McCracken, author of Chief Culture Officer. By 1969, you've got 500,000 people showing up for entertainment in an open field. So it's a tremendously rapid acceleration. And I think one of the ways it gets accomplished, culturally speaking, is that people just simply define themselves in a very careful opposition to the cultural model that was in place by the mid-50s. The post-war period was a time of remarkable economic growth, epitomized by the rise of suburbs and what that symbolized for material comfort and the competition for social standing. As a 1950s Ford television commercial put it, why have one car when you can have two? But many members of the nonconformist 60s generation spurned status and individualistic competition in favor of egalitarianism and social solidarity. Spending a weekend in a muddy field seemed like a good idea for starters, because it so affirmed the equality of all those people, says Mr. McCracken. Everything about the clothing and the hair was pretty deliberately an effort to efface differences. But what lay behind the sudden youthful attraction to human beings, that's human beings, HUMANBEINS, a supposedly humanistic version of the old sit-ins, Eastern mysticism and drugs? And why did some flower children display a disregard for clothing that would make even the cast of hair blush? It was a desire for personal empowerment and expression. Earlier generations believed that if you lived in accordance with the social mores of your community, you'd be happy. But the boomers balked at that notion. First, they said, follow your bliss. Second, find a community that you fit into. This so-called me generation's redefinition of freedom included a rejection of their parents' conservatism and the morality of the middle class. Political upheaval, the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and two Kennedys, race riots, and fear of the draft only fueled their disaffection. They challenged authority, agitated for civil rights and women's rights, and embraced sexual liberation. At the time, the most potent messengers for change were musicians. On a spring morning, Donnie York surveys the field where his group, Sha-Na-Na, played just prior to Jimi Hendrix 50 years ago. Revivalists of the 1950s doo-wop rock and roll have returned for Woodstock commemorative show at the Bethel Woods Center for the Arts. There were unknowns the first time around. The festival and a subsequent documentary movie turned them into stars. My helicopter landed maybe between here and the stage, recalls Mr. York, whose West Side Story garb, a leather jacket and rolled up jeans, looks as anachronistic now as it did in 1969. I'd never seen so many people in one place. The backcountry roads were jammed with cars and minibuses, muraled with flowers. When Bob Mulvey arrived, he was dangerously hanging out the open back of a U-Haul truck that he and some friends had stuffed with mattresses. Most festival goers arrived far less prepared. We had a bunch of food in the truck, so we gave away some, says Mr. Mulvey, now a teacher at Berklee College of Music in Boston. Conditions deteriorated. First, food vendors' supplies ran out. Then their boots collapsed after a storm produced the worst mud since the Battle of Passchendaele. Upon hearing about the shortages, locals collected food donations, including 10,000 sandwiches, and airlifted them into festivals' makeshift kitchens. Thousands of cups of granola were passed from hand to hand to those crammed near the stage. They had sort of a free food setup, which was really interesting, says Mr. Mulvey. I remember sitting down with just this huge group of people that we didn't know, and sharing food and laughing and joking about the size of the crowd. Chaninage Jaco Marcelino recalls venturing out among the masses because the artist's hospitality pavilion had been turned into a medical station. At the top of the hill, he watched Creedence Clearwater Revival play Born on the Bayou. The band looked microscopic, but the stage lights reflected off the drummer's cymbals as shimmering halo rings. It really was a great weekend of cooperation, says Mr. Marcelino. And that spirit made it so special that there wasn't anybody fighting. There wasn't anybody burning things. People took care of each other, and it gave an important spiritual background to it. The good vibes emanated from the stage, starting with the acoustic guitar-oriented lineup on Friday night. Most folk acts were protest acts. I'm thinking, obviously, of Joan Baez, who was the headliner for that day, and Arlo Guthrie, the son of Woody Guthrie, and obviously very politically committed, says Julian Baitun, author of The Story of Woodstock Live. There was the Fixin' to Die Rag by Country Joe McDonald, and 1, 2, 3, What Are We Fighting For? Don't Ask Me, I Don't Give a Damn. Next Step is Vietnam, with the whole crowd chanting. The greatest protest song of the festival was entirely wordless, Hendrix's instrumental version of the Star-Spangled Banner. Made the strings of his upside-down Stratocaster howl in distorted anguish. It was the aural equivalent of a flag burning. The performance helped to establish the festival's legendary status, says Mr. Batoon. A few songs later, Woodstock was over. The community was sort of engendered at that moment, and then dissipated afterwards, says Jefferson Airplane guitarist Jorma Kokkonen. That's the kind of thing you can't really put into words or planning. All these people showed up. All this stuff happened. And they were sort of like a little Woodstock city for 3 days. And then it was gone. The magic. That's magic to me. Mr. Mulvey remembers arriving home from Woodstock with his pants covered in dried mud. His father, who was pretty liberal, looked at him and shook his head. But for the young aspiring musician, those 3 days forged a shared cultural identity. Woodstock is a sort of pinnacle of that sort of value system being created, and understanding that there were many, many others like me, he says. If there were 500,000 people there, that probably meant that another 500,000 couldn't get there, which means it was 1,000,000 people who kind of shared those values, and probably even more than that. The mythology of Woodstock began almost immediately. Joni Mitchell, who didn't attend, wrote the infamous song about it. The central refrain, "We've got to get ourselves back to the garden," conjured up images of festival goers dwelling in Edenic serenity. It reinforced a narrative of Woodstock's fitting into the centuries-old American impulse to create a utopian society, however briefly, as evidenced by the Shakers, Transcendentalists, and others in early New England. Yet within months, those utopian ideals suddenly seemed far more difficult to attain. In December of 1969, Mr. Lang's attempt to mount a Woodstock West at Altamont Speedway in California was marred by the death of an 18-year-old at the hands of a Hell's Angels security team. The turn of the decade also brought fresh challenges for the boomer generation. Almost as soon as people had decamped from that farm in Woodstock, the economy started souring, says Joseph Sternberg, author of The Theft of a Decade, How the Baby Boomers Stole the Millennials' Economic Future. I mean, you got to get the oil crisis of the 1970s. The culminating fiasco of that era was the stagflation of the late 70s and then the deep recession of the early 80s. Mr. Sternberg says a defining characteristic of boomers is that they're always chasing the economic security that they grew up with in their childhoods. Only a slice of that generation identified as hippies, but many of them swapped their caftans for suits and ties. The generation's politics, too, shifted, with many later voting for Ronald Reagan. Now, in their twilight years, boomers are assessing their place in the world. Ms. Vandergoot says many of her contemporaries are gentle activists, no longer as strident as they once were, yet keenly involved in their communities and politics. You get that kind of split between people who become more pragmatic about their idealism, but are still idealist. And then there are people who kind of gave in and said, hey, you know, I had a good run at it. I did what I could, but now I just want to have a comfortable life as I coast through a few more decades. She believes her generation still has spiritual impulses that challenge a proclivity to seek refuge in middle-class comforts. They carried forward those deep values, the sense of life can't be purely material and be satisfying, says Miss Vandergoot. We know that we won't always be around. We want to believe that there's more than just us. Nowadays, the hippie is an endangered species, seldom spotted outside of its natural habitat of fish concerts. That's fish, P-H-I-S-H, by the way. But Mr. Mulvey says some of his Berkeley students, fascinated to discover he attended Woodstock, are curious about its generation's values. His students often tell him that the hippies of the time had more things to protest. His rejoinder to them is that the issues of civil rights, war, gay rights, women's rights, and the environment haven't gone away. Progress has been made, but there's still work to be done. Yet the idea of music as a countercultural movement doesn't resonate with the younger generation. Music has changed somewhat in terms of its importance to the students I work with, he says. Music is a commodity as much as it is an art form. Mr. Kalkonian of Jefferson Airplane, who has a 12-year-old daughter and a 21-year-old son, wishes that today's young musicians were inspired to write protest songs like his generation did. It's just a different world. I think the issues today are not as clear-cut, says Mr. Kalkonian, still an in-demand recording and touring songwriter. The issues were so clear-cut back then. There was really very little gray area between what you believed and what you didn't, and the music and the writing and the graphic art that were done by people of that generation were inextricably intertwined with the current events of the time. The article does go on for about 3 more paragraphs. However, we have reached the end of our half an hour of the Christian Science Monitor this week. I'm Philip Moore for Radio Reading Services. Thanks for joining me. Join me again next week when we take a look at another edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly here on WRRS.